has a challenge which must be responded to. And this challenge is not.
You're listening to Surface Planet Radio with your host Erickson on WGDR and WGDH Goddard College Community Radio. In the next 2 hours, we will be exploring such topics as metaphysics, spiritual law, alternative health, personal empowerment, and channeled messages, with talks from international authors. The following program presents the opinion of its participants and producer. It does not reflect an official opinion of WGDR and WGDH or its licensee, Goddard College. And now, here is your host, Erickson, on Surface Planet Radio.
Good morning out there, this is Erickson and you're listening to WGDR Plainfield and WGDH Hardwick. Coming up on my show, we will be having a live telephone interview with Jan Rigsby. Questions are welcome. The number here at the station is 1-800-646-9437. So earlier this morning, we were listening to Jiddu Krishnamurti, otherwise known as Jay Krishnamurti, who spent his last years in beautiful Ojai, California, close to where I lived as a child and young man, Santa Barbara, California. And he was quite a spiritual warrior. He rejected quite a lot of dogmatic beliefs and blazed his own trail, and he has a wealth of information out there with many books that were transcribed from his lectures. So Jiddu Krishnamurti is a great resource, and coming up probably at around 6:10, we'll have Jan Rigsby, who is a pathwork teacher. She spent time in California teaching pathwork. She learned the pathwork material over 10 years, and what that is channeled material from Eva Parakis. Some spiritual psychology, and it might be the future psychology that gets adopted by the mainstream if we're lucky. So hang on and we'll get right into that with Jan Rigsby, and we will be taking callers. The number here is 1-800-646-9437 if you have any questions. So here's a little bit more of Krishnamurti before we get into the main show.
Fixing the mind on one idea or one thought or one symbol and so on, which every schoolboy does when he reads a book, when he is forced to read. And there's not much difference between the student in the school and the very deep thinker who tries tremendously to concentrate on one idea or one image and try to discover some reality out of that. And also, there are various forms of stimulation. Forcing oneself, stimulating oneself to reach a point from which you see life totally differently. And that is to expand consciousness more and more through will, through effort, through concentration, through determination to force. And by extending this consciousness, one hopes to arrive at a different state or a different dimension or reach a point which the conscious mind cannot. Or one takes many, many drugs, including the LSD, the latest LSD and so on and so on, that gives for the moment tremendous stimulation to the whole system. And in that state, one experiences extraordinary things. Extraordinary things through stimulation, through concentration, through discipline, through starvation, fasting. If one fasts for some days, one has obviously peculiar things happening. And one takes drugs, and that for the moment makes the body extraordinarily sensitive. You see colors which are most extraordinary, which you've never seen before. You see everything so clearly, there is no space between you and that thing which you see. And this goes on in various forms throughout the world. The repetition of words, like in the Catholic, or in those prayers, which all make the mind little calm, quiet.
All right, so here I am back again, and Jan Rigsby, are you on the other end?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. So in the background, we were listening to a little Jay Krishnamurti, and he was talking about images, which somewhat leads into what we're going to talk about today. I called Jan a couple of weeks ago, asking her to come on, and she was on last fall, and today's hypothetical topic is the holidays, stress over holidays, finances, and relationships, which is everybody can relate to, and a specific lecture, which is called The Illusory Fear of Self, which is 136 from the Pathwork website, pathwork.com, I believe, or pathwork.org. Pathwork.org. And there's Pathwork is a compilation of channeled lectures taken by Eva Parakis, who was from Austria, Germany. And so she started quite a while ago in the 1960s, I believe.
1956 in America,
which is quite a long time for someone to be channeling, and an early period, right? And I guess I was listening to something interesting, is her husband was involved with Wilhelm Reich. Is that correct?
Yes, that's why her name is Eva Paracas. She came here as Eva Brauch.
Uh-huh.
Eva. And in the late 60s, early 60s, can't remember when, she married John Paracas, who had developed bioenergetics with Alexander Lowen. And Paracas and Lowen were disciples of Wilhelm Reich.
Wow.
Who believed that the body held the key to resolving difficulties emotionally and intellectually.
That's pretty amazing, bioenergetics. And what is the modern version of bioenergetics?
When John met Eva, he felt that her material, the work that she was channeling, provided the spiritual component that he was looking for. And so he split from Alexander Lowen then and developed core energetics. However, if you read Lowen wrote the books. John was not a writer, but Lowen has written many, many books. You will see that Lowen also followed a spiritual tone. He was just doing it more gradually. And John leapt into the idea of involving spirit when he met Eva. So bioenergetics still exists and is still taught, and core energetics is I don't want to say slightly different, but it's not radically different. It has different methods and a different underpinning.
Is bioenergetics part of the reflexology practice that we see now?
It has similarities. In bioenergetics and core energetics, what you do is you place stress on the body. And the reason you do that is the body holds tension. Mm-hmm. It's a natural reflex, and that's not reflexology, but it's a natural reflex for the body to hold tension and contain so that you don't fly off and just lay on the floor and throw a tantrum. So in the process work, the idea is to mildly fatigue the major muscles in the body so that the energy starts to flow outwards, feelings starts to come out. The kinds of feelings that we naturally restrain in business meetings and in conversation. And this is appropriate to restrain them, but at some point it becomes over-restrained and we don't even know what those feelings are.
Mm-hmm.
So you fatigue with various exercises, the major postural muscles of the body, and for a lot of people, almost immediately, feelings start bubbling to the surface. Reflexology is technically that done only with the foot.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So perhaps pressure points in the foot?
Mm-hmm.
And pressing of the pressure points to... There's ear reflexology too, right? In hand.
Yes. So basically, reflexology is looking for, I don't want to interpret it, that's not my field of expertise, mm-hmm. but it's as if reflexology focuses on very tiny chakras that exist all over the body.
Mm.
And bioenergetics and core energetics are focusing on the primary chakras that a lot of people are aware of.
Okay. And does this go into Brennan healing? I know there's a lot of synthesis between path work and Brennan healing. That's how I found the path work is through a Brennan healer that was working on me to align my chakras and, you know, clear up debris. Collected debris from the past and stuff like that.
Well, Barbara Brennan was a pathwork helper. And because at that time, since John and Eva were married, he was very involved with the pathwork community. So she became a core energetics therapist. And then she began to develop her own personal talents for spiritual healing and an understanding of how the auric field interrelates with all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So pathwork and core energetics underlies her work, and she added to it with a whole new layer.
Yeah, a very rich layer, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see here. I guess we can jump right into what you had planned to talk about, and I'll ask you any questions that I come up with. And if any callers would like to call in with questions, you can call 1-800-646-9437. So that's 646-9437, and this is Jan Rigsby, a pathwork teacher and helper. So, and you're in down there in New York City, and you spent time teaching in Australia. You started a pathwork program in Australia, and then you were in California, and now you're in New York. And
So let me give this a little bit of an overview, and I'm very happy to be interrupted with questions by anyone, because it is specific questions that the work is all about. So you can lecture on this stuff, you can explain it, but the explanations and the structure and the concepts don't mean much unless you put them to work. And you need to put them to work in your own life. So what I thought I'd do is I would slightly reverse the process when you asked me to do this around this time. Knowing that people get stressed over the holidays, I have already been stressed over the holidays. Mm-hmm. I thought we've got all this experience out there, and it might be useful to describe some of the concepts in pathwork that might allow people to take those concepts and examine their experiences and make more sense of them. And when you become more conscious of why you're upset or what it's about, it is a little easier to be more objective about it, not get triggered, not connect dots erroneously. In other words, we leap to conclusions sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how much truth there may be in what we feel and what we say, if we clog that information with false assumptions, it triggers other people. And so you have what I call the baseball bat syndrome, where the way you chose sides in baseball, you have a bat, and you throw it in the air, and one person catches it, and then you do hand over hand with the other person, and the person who caps the top wins, and that team gets to bat. And sometimes that's what it feels like, that escalation process in a family meeting or in an interaction. And what's nice is if you begin to see what this might be about, you can slow it down a little bit and at least not contribute, so that feelings stay manageable and you can sort through what might be actually going on. So that's my intention with this. So what I thought was that it would be the three topics that would be useful to understand is some defenses that we go into, the difference between emotional reactions and feelings, which sounds very weird to people the first time they hear it. I'll explain that in a moment. And the third thing is a major concept in pathwork, which is images. Now, any one of these three, you can do an entire weekend workshop on.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm going to do is put the idea out there, and what I hope is that your audience can take these ideas and begin to notice which, if any, are something that they see happening in their lives. And then instead of rolling with it, they can say, wonder what that is, and begin the process of taking a look at what's happening instead of just being shanghaied by what's going on in the moment.
Uh-huh.
So if we break that down, like I say, all of these are either weekend workshops or a year's work. In terms of defenses, I thought I would speak about one primary Pafford lecture concept, which is Pafford Lecture 143, and it's called Unity and Duality. So you can look it up by number, or you can look it up by title on the pathwork.org website. That's the major foundation. All the lectures are free. You can download them. And what that's about is this. The idea is that there is a unitive state of being, and that's what heaven, what spirit is about. However, we don't live there. We live here. And on this planet, we are hardwired in many, many ways by the laws of nature. When you fall down, it hurts. Mm-hmm. When you jump up, you come down. You either live or you die. And what that does is that breeds in us a sense of dualistic thinking. So we tend to see things in a slightly immature way. And by immature, I don't mean ravingly immature. I mean perhaps not spiritually mature. That we see things in terms of or. I'm either happy or I'm not. And it's a way of looking at the end of the rainbow or the beginning of the rainbow and ignoring the number of shades in between. Mm-hmm. It's black or white, right or wrong, good or bad, life or death. And if we don't examine these natural tendencies, we can get into a rut in the road of thinking what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong. And we're not looking at the fact that something can be not quite right, but good enough. Not wrong, but not necessarily avoidable at this moment. So the study of dualistic thinking comes from our bodies. The body is, again, hardwired to stay alive at all costs. So we spoke a moment ago about reflexology. Reflexes are the body's way of not asking your permission to not keep your finger in the flame.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Reflexes and instincts are your body's way of knowing what's safe and what's not and avoiding anything that's not safe. But hear the duality in that, safe or not safe. The body does not have a sense of values. It doesn't judge the importance of something unless one instinct overwhelms the other. So when a mother or father risks death to save a child, what's actually happening is they have the instinct of self-preservation, but they've also got the instinct of procreation. They're going to save that child because that is also part of the body's instinctive makeup. So that's a lot of theory, but that's the physiological basis for dualistic thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings are more complex than amoebas. So we take that basic survival mechanism and we overlay it onto our emotions. And that's not so bad, but then we overlay it onto society.
Mm.
And what happens is in a very short period of time, give or take 6 or 7 years, so by the time a child is 8 years old, they have the feeling that if they're not nice to their friends, they will become friendless.
Yeah.
If they do not do what mom says, mom will withdraw. And what it feels like to the child is that mom is pulling back her love. Not true, but the child is young. It doesn't understand. By the way, this experience happens earlier, but the child becomes aware more or less after about the age of 7. So human beings are trained to incorporate duality into their emotional reality, into their social and cultural reality, and later they will spill that over into their spiritual reality. So God becomes the judge. God becomes the arbiter. He decides what's good and bad. He sent the word down, and we have to stay within a certain confine. Instead of accepting our responsibility as a human being to to look at situations for what they are in the moment. So as children, we tend to react to authority figures, and as adults, some of us stay beholden to authority figures rather than taking charge of our own lives. So that's the premise in dualistic thinking. So you've got all these layers, and dualistic thinking can permeate any or all of these layers. So as a defense, dualistic thinking is used when we are frustrated, when we want something and we're trying to get it, and it's also especially used to combat authority.
Yeah. I can feel that.
Go ahead.
I have a situation or situations where I hear people just barking things at other people, and it's sort of like the French way. I hear the French are a lot of, into being very rude to strangers on the bus and whatnot, and they're actually telling, they have advertisements now, or a little, you know, placard saying, you know, let's be kind to, you know, the tourists instead of rude. But it seems pretty prevalent these days where you sort of have to bark to get attention with all the competition for people's attention. And I've heard people say that attention is sort of a currency, if you will, like paying attention. You pay somebody your attention. And that, and a lot of people, especially kids, seem to be vying for the attention of the parent. And then that can turn around into an adult vying for the attention of the, you know, the boss or whatnot. So that's...
So one of the things that Pathwork works with is the world is not fair. You can pay and you don't receive. You can pay attention to someone else and not get your share. That's the way the world works sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that can build up resentments. And I lived in France for 2 years, so I know of what you speak. But I've lived in New York for 4 years, and I know that people think that New Yorkers are rude also. My experience of both cultures is that that is a defense mechanism to get through the day.
Mm-hmm.
The people individually are not like that necessarily, but that's how you cope with the stress of your society. And it becomes an acceptable way to do it. It's as if the whole culture society says, you don't have to pay attention to me while I'm in the subway. You don't have to treat me like an individual. Just give me a shove and I'll move. It's shorthand that allows us to all move through the day, or literally move through the subway tubes without having to interact and ask permission and spend forever negotiating all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And as a culture, we understand these shortcuts. But when a stranger comes into this culture from a different speed of interaction, a different realm of shortcuts, they judge us as rude. I remember one time I was in New England on business, and the New Englanders think that the people from Boston are rude. And they told me this story. They said, we went into a pizza parlor down in Boston, and the waiter walked up and said, what do you want? And said, we don't know. And she said, I'll come back when you're ready, and walked off. They thought that was rude.
Oh.
I thought that was efficient.
Yeah.
I thought, good for her. She's not going to bug them or make them feel bad.
And this is really what we're
but
trying.
But that's not how people act in New England.
This is really what we're trying to navigate here, right? With the holidays, it's
right.
Like you're trying to do something nice, you know, say give a gift or something, and it's like there's all sorts of pitfalls that you fall into, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people take things all 100 ways except the way you want them to take it.
Right.
Or perhaps you don't care how they take it. which is sort of a defense mechanism, wouldn't you say?
Well, if we take that, just that little circle that you described, just taking those generic, gentle phrases, you have an agenda. You want to give a gift. The other person has an agenda, and it doesn't see or respect as a priority your agenda. But you also don't see or respect the fact that that's not their priority. And that's how we basically wind up in traffic jams or traffic accidents emotionally.
And an emotional traffic accident.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Happens all the time.
Yes. And when we, again, holidays stress this. So from a larger perspective, isn't it wonderful to have holidays, have these blow-ups, have this stress, and then whoosh, oh, we're going to go back to normal. So there's a cycle within us that can appreciate having a little bit of emotionality in the middle of winter and then go into the new year feeling like, well, we cleared that up. Hopefully, if you cleared it up.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that little experience that you described of wanting to give a gift, I'd like to take that, not in your experience, so I'm not trying to project on you what you meant, but I'd love to take that and, pardon the pun, unwrap it.
Feel free.
Okay. So again, when I talk about things theoretically, it's not about the individual person because I'd have to talk to that person for a while to understand their deeper motives. But it's a common thing to want to give a gift. But the motives aren't common. Okay? The motives can be thousands of motives for giving a gift. And what Pathwork is about is uncovering the real source of the agenda. For instance, you can give a gift because you have felt like you haven't honored that person throughout the year. When they don't receive that gift, that confirms your suspicion that they never really liked you in the first place. Mommy always liked Tommy best. You know, there's a thousand things going on in us that the offering of a gift is holding without our knowledge. So when someone basically puts the gift on the ground and say, I'll open it later, they're not putting the gift on the ground. They're putting our self-esteem on the ground. They're putting our self-worth. They're putting our apologies for being a human being and screwing up throughout the year on the ground and saying, you don't matter. You're not important. And that's where we will really get upset about that. The gift is not what we're upset about. But if you don't do this kind of work, self-analysis work, self-examination, you can confuse that. And what you'll say is, you do not respect giving. You do not respect somebody's time and effort. And you make it objective, and you make it about them.
Mm-hmm.
And as anyone who has done negotiation or supervision of employees or volunteer work, it doesn't help when you point a finger at someone and say, it's your fault that I'm not happy. Okay?
Yes.
So when you do the self-examination, sometimes what you have to do is you have to swallow hard and say, timing wasn't right. Maybe they'll take a look at the gift tonight or tomorrow. And my intention can still follow through, but my presentation did not come out the way I wanted it to come out. This moment did not succeed in the way I imagined it to succeed. Okay, and that is about taking responsibility for the fact that there were little strings attached to that gift and letting them go and letting the other person be who they are and have their agendas and hoping that there might still be a meeting place for the two of you. It may be that this person, I'm going to go back and start over, it may be that in giving this gift, you had an aha about who they are what they like, what would make them happy. And that is a thrilling thing to have, a realization about another person. So you give the gift, and what you want to do is you want to give joy to someone. Mm. And they're not in the mood to feel joyful. So that can feel like an attack against your own creativity. It's you can fill in the blanks here. It can feel like a personal attack that this person isn't in the mood to feel joyful. Once again, in self-analysis, sometimes we aren't in the mood to feel joyful either. And being pressured by somebody else, here, eat this, taste this, see this, do this, mm-hmm. is not a path to joy. So if we understand what the agenda is, and we can figure out some way to support the agenda and give up on how it is to be enacted. And I can trace that back to what I was talking about, duality. Dualistically, either you become joyful or I fail. Well, I wanted you to become joyful. I made a plan. I made effort. I wrapped it up. I hope that at some point you might receive and understand the invitation for joy, but I'm going to let go of how and let you do it in your own time. That's hard work.
I have a funny story for you, Jen.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I really used to be into pranks, you know. And I had this this bag of saltwater taffy with different obnoxious flavors in it, like really bad flavors. And you never knew what bad flavor you were going to get. This taffy started off sweet and yummy, and then it turned to, like, you know, beef gravy or something. And I gave it to this girl that I knew in school. I knew her, but I didn't know her that well. And we were in the park, and I handed her this taffy. And she was like, oh, thank you. And she was really grateful. And then she was getting halfway through it. And the look on her face was just priceless. And it was mean on my part, I admit. But she got so angry when she started tasting whatever the flavor it was. She didn't tell me what it was, of course. She was more interested in beating me up, and I was running. But that was a pointed gift, if you will. And then I got another story. When I was a kid, my stepmother would make these raspberry pies. You know, she lived in Vermont. I would visit. So for Christmas, I picked out this pie tin. And I wrapped it in a big, huge box. She's like, I wonder what's in this box. You know, she was really anticipating what I had given her. And she unwrapped it, and it's a pie tin. And of course, you know, she goes with it. Maybe I should make you a pie.
Now, that is a beautiful way to receive a gift.
Yes.
You may have wanted to make her laugh or tease her or usurp her, but my read of this is that you were teasing about something that she already did, that you appreciated, mm-hmm. and she got the connection between the gift and that. Ah. Pie making must be on your mind, even if it's just a joke about a big present that's actually a small gift.
Yes. Oh.
And you know that what people can do with that is, depending on their mood, which we cannot control their mood, they could have wanted a personal and special gift that day. And they see this big box or small box, and they open it, and you don't know that they've got that secret need. And when they open it and it's a joke, they're not in the mood for a joke. And that's where they can become angry or cynical or all kinds of things can come out. It's not really about the joke. So again, it sounds like you were very well received. Was it your mom or your aunt or your grandmother?
My father's second wife.
Stepmother, right.
Yeah.
Sorry, I missed it. It sounds like that was a really good receiving of a kid's joke.
It was actually...
Focus on the connection between the two of you.
Yeah.
That's why I brought up these topics during this time, is that kind of response can create stronger ties between people.
Mm-hmm.
And to be mature enough to put aside our, gosh, I really wanted, you know, a piece of jewelry, or I really wanted to get out of the kitchen and somebody gives me a pie tin. To recognize the difference between our personal needs and the possible reality of what is going on. Okay? So I know that we skip around a bit and we've got some more time left, but I'm going to skip the rest of the dualistic, which I'm happy to go back to, and go into the second topic that I was hoping to bring up, and that is emotional reactions versus feelings.
Okay.
Now, for some people, that's just a bizarre. What do you mean versus? Because aren't they the same thing? But, for instance, using this example, a feeling is actually quite objective. A feeling is seeing something that has some truth in it. And an emotional reaction is quite subjective, not necessarily based in truth, and highly difficult for other people to predict or know. So again, using this example, I love succinct little examples like this. To receive a gift and realize the underlying connection that connects the gift, whether or not that's what you wanted to receive, and to comment on that connection and allow that connection to be felt by the other person is a feeling. It's a feeling of connection. And a feeling of being seen by the other person. Maybe not for what you wanted to be seen for that day, but you're still seen. And you can turn your little disco ball around and say, oh, you're looking at that facet. I was actually hoping you'd see this facet. But that's okay. It's still part of who I am. An emotional reaction would focus on what I wanted today was to be appreciative of my womanhood. And you, you little scamp, can't and won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
That would be an emotional reaction because it wouldn't include you. And part of the reason it wouldn't, it's not in truth, is it presumes what the other person has in their mind instead of looking for what might be true. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. The trap you can fall into easily.
Yeah. So, continue with emotional reactions. When we are in reaction, because we're actually, it's like a hole in the dike. It's not about the little hole. It's about what's behind that dike.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, in an emotional reaction, one of the telltale signs that it is an emotional reaction and not a feeling is the reaction is much stronger than what seems reasonable. So if you tell me a story and I get sad or weepy, even if I cry a little bit or go, oh, that's still a feeling. But if I dissolve into tears and you can't shake me out of it for 5 minutes, that's an emotional reaction. Because that what has happened is the story has touched into something that I have not previously understood or accepted or felt. Now, I'm not saying that emotional reaction is bad, because it's a good thing to tap into something that hasn't been released or felt and to feel it. It's a wonderful thing to do that. And that is what happens, for instance, when we go to weddings and we cry. It's not about the wedding. Weddings are happy things.
Mm-hmm.
But it touches into all the dreams we had about our own relationships and all the things about our personal history that have to do with the joining of two people together and what happens after that. So it's a good thing to tap into that and feel it. But if we don't identify it as being about us and some unresolved personal issue, then what we're likely to do is basically tie the crying to what the other person did in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I cried because the wedding wasn't as nice as I thought it should be for you. That's not why you cried. You cried because of a memory. Okay. So to project that onto today and basically say to the other person, you're responsible for my strong reaction, is not being in truth. So that's why to look at emotional reactions versus feelings. Now, a feeling can be very, very strong, but once it's expressed, it tends to be over. The way I explain it is, if you step on my foot and hurt me, I am going to, ow, get off my foot. Mm-hmm. And I may be angry about that, but you get off my foot, and the feeling fades away, and I'm done with that. But if you step on my foot and my toe is sore, and it continues to throb and hurt, and I blame you because your stepping on my toe is what is creating my distress for half an hour, that's an emotional reaction. Because the toe was sore to begin with. And what you did was you triggered the existing problem. Now, I tend to be a science and body person because I love it when spiritual concepts can be brought into daily life and into what we see and hear and especially into our body. So an emotional reaction is like poking somebody and accidentally hitting a pussy wound and the pus pours out.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's not because somebody poked it. That was there. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing to cleanse that wound. But if the underlying cause of the pus isn't worked on, it's just going to pus over again. And that's what emotional reactions, that's why they're there. And that's sometimes why they don't go away. We haven't found the underlying cause.
The splinter.
Yes. Very often spiritual disciplines will call that a thorn.
Thorn.
Mm-hmm. Because splinters tend not to make quite as big a wound as a thorn. And in path work, what we talk about is a different way of perceiving why we're here in the first place. According to path work, we are here because we are holding inside our soul, inside our spirit, we are holding misconceptions, false beliefs, and misconceptions, false beliefs, and I'll figure it out later. And we know that in spirit. We know those are misconceptions and distortions.
Mm-hmm.
We know what those are, but we don't know how to let go of them. We don't know why they're there. And we partly don't believe that they're bad. We're tempted to believe maybe they're true. So Patrick says we come to this planet to act them out. We're not here for fun, although life can be fun. We're not here for joy, although life can be joyful. We're here to manifest our crazy idea that bad is good and good is bad. And watch it enact in our lives. And finally say, that's not a great idea. That's not in truth. And to release the belief, the distortion, the misconception, and then to continue living and notice, ooh, that's much better. So that when we die and we recycle back, whether you believe we come back again or not does not matter, when we recycle and go back up into spirit, we're not holding that false belief, that misconception, that distortion. So just to touch upon it before this first hour is up, for just a second, that's where images come in. And that was our third topic. Mm-hmm. So images are a manifestation of our false belief. I'll give you some quick examples. Men will hurt you. Women will betray you. Crime doesn't pay. Crime pays. I just made a list of the quickies.
Yeah.
All of those human statements, if you ask somebody who believes that, they will tell you story after story after story that proves that that is true.
Yes.
And yet we hear what we want to hear and we see what we want to see. And so we simply don't recognize the stories that contradict our belief systems and our images until those don't work anymore. Until those images create pain, hurt other people or hurt us, until we can see the damage that such false beliefs create. And then comes the moment of epiphany, transformation, and we become willing to see that this is a false belief. I'm time conscious. I can give you a slight example that is somewhat objective. I collect articles from all kinds of sources, and I found this article on a site about Dustin Hoffman when he was preparing for the 1982 film Tootsie. And his epiphany about that led him to embrace the role and really, I think that's why it's a great movie, is he believed in what the movie demonstrated. And it demonstrated what he felt when he was preparing for the role. So he went there and they transformed. He liked the script. It wasn't that he didn't like it, but it wasn't an epiphany for him. He went there and they made him up, and he looked in the mirror and said, well, that's great, but you need to make me beautiful, because if I'm going to be a woman, I need to be a beautiful woman.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, please laugh with me, that this is as good as we can do. I'm sorry, Dustin, but you're just not beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
In the conventional sense of womanhood.
Yeah.
And what he said was, that was his epiphany. And he said the movie was never a comedy. He said, I went home and started crying because I think I am an interesting woman when I look at myself on screen.
Yeah.
And I know that if I met myself at a party, I would never talk to that character.
Hmm. No, that's sad for him.
Okay, that's one response. And that feeds into what the guide says about feelings. We can feel sad upon learning how we were in a false belief.
Mm-hmm.
But the long term is we can feel happiness and relief that we have exposed that false belief, that now we know about it. And we can begin the process of not being trapped forever in that false belief. So his epiphany was he had seen women in a certain way, and he stopped. Not forever and for always and every moment, but he stopped being unconscious of that belief.
All right. I guess when we come back, we'll find out how Dustin Hoffman came to terms with that hurtful realization that he would not want to talk to himself if he saw him dressed in drag in a corner.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we'll be back with Jan Rigsby, pathwork teacher, at 7 a.m.
All right. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, too.
This is WGDR Plainfield and WGDH Hardwick.
All right, so on the line we have Jan Rigsby, pathwork teacher and helper. And we can get right back into it. Hello, Jan. And Jan, I met about a year ago, and I first discovered you on YouTube. You have quite a few videos up there on YouTube, and they were super helpful for me trying to navigate my way through this pathwork thing, this spiritual practice. And I encourage people to go check out Jan Rigsby, janrigsby.com. JANRIGBSY.com.
No, GSBY.
Oh, sorry. A little bit of dyslexia going on.
Okay.
So, anyhow, now, and if you'd like to call in, the number is 646-9437, 1-800-646-9437. I might have scared everybody off last Friday with my UFO talk, so we'll see if we get some callers. But anywho, now, how would Dustin Hoffman get over the fact that he is not the beautiful woman that he would like to talk to if he was at a party?
So let's put this in context again. Basically, this was an epiphany he had because of the movie role that he took. And I think that the expression that he makes, that he realized that he judges women by their looks instead of by who they are. I don't think it's about him in specific. I think it's about people in general. That tells you something about his state of realization. In other words, there's an awareness at that moment. Okay. What he does about it is of less importance than the fact that he not only made the movie, he did the interviews. So he didn't just accidentally make that movie that had such a profound truth inside it, which is, I think, why the movie was popular. Why it became a classic. It wasn't just an accident. It was because he understood the intent of the movie, which was the intent of the movie as far as the author was concerned, Pollock. And he put energy into giving people an experience of that.
Mm-hmm.
Once you do that, once you admit something to yourself, admit it to other people, and take action based on that. I have no idea what he did with his life regarding that. But I do know that that becomes a reality in your life, and it permits you to open up. And that may be a little bit foggy, but what I'm trying to say is there's awareness, then there's understanding, and then there's a knowing. And this is tracking a lecture in Pathwork. It's called the spirit, the Four Stages of Spiritual Evolution.
Mm-hmm.
It's Pathwork Lecture 127. Can be downloaded for free from www.pathwork.org. And I also use it on my websites. I have study guides with it. And what the four stages of spiritual evolution say is stage one, which doesn't sound like a stage, but it is being blissfully ignorant. You are dumb as a post. You have no clue. And no work can be done at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The work that is being done is you are creating the evidence of the false belief or misconception. So if Dustin Hoffman hadn't seen in his own life how he had treated women like that, it wouldn't be so powerful for him to realize the deeper truth, which is that's not appropriate. That's not in truth. It's not fair. It's not nice. Any words you want.
Yeah.
But if he had simply been given that concept, he'd say, yeah, you know, of course it's not right. It is only when we see our own racism, our own prejudice, when we can go back in our mind, like flipping through a Rolodex, and go through the experiences of when we were a jerk, and now we know what that might have been about, and we realize the hurt we might have created other people, whether or not they realized it.
Oh.
That we can really let that realization soak in. Just the phrase that he made, that I wouldn't have talked to that woman if I'd met her at a party, allows him to understand how he acted out his false belief, misconception. And if it goes deeply enough and we do a little self-analysis, we can unplug from that. Now, that takes time. And that's where people get frustrated. They say, but I realize that biting my nails wasn't a good idea. Agreed. And I'm picking a trivial example because it's simpler to describe.
Mm-hmm.
If you realize you're doing something that's not healthy, that's not a good idea, and you say, I don't want to do that, that's great, that's wonderful. But it's tied to a complex series of being nervous, of being a little, having some emotions suppressed. It's tied to a lot of things that you may not be conscious of. So just attacking the effect of that isn't effective, once again, to make a pun. So for heaven knows I have no idea what was going on in his mind, but just taking this example of what he said in an interview, if he's prejudiced on one place, he's probably prejudiced on a half dozen others. And there may be a central reason for that. And it's based in his own personal experience, because it's certainly not based in fact. And the work is to find out what might have influenced our belief, our false belief, and to realize and then feel the feelings. And that takes us into the realm of images. So I think it'd be easier if I switched there rather than imagining what one person thought. So switching to images, which is a huge series of lectures and concepts. It's a very big concept in Pathwork, and so there are a lot of lectures that are about images. If you think of an incident, or if I say to you, what was happy in your life, you might be able to give me 10 examples.
Mm-hmm.
The 10 examples that you might give me might look like those little movies we shoot with our phones.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can say, oh, I remember the day in the park, and this, and that, and the other, and you see it like a moving picture.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was pleasant and you had no reason to suppress any of it. And that memory comes to you, and you see it, and it flows, and you feel the feelings, even if they weren't all pleasant. We were in the park, and we had a picnic. Oh, and I ate a bad hot dog, and I was sick that night. But it's not intermixed with trauma, or disappointment, or a challenge to your existence. Because if you got sick and people took care of you, you just got sick and then the next day you got better. Images happen when we go in, when we experience shock and trauma. And I'm a film buff, so people might relate. Film uses some of those techniques. We don't see a lovely, calm, moving review of what actually happened. When we've been experienced to shock and trauma, it's like we see a photograph, and then another photograph, and then another photograph, and there's a disconnect. Because when we're in trauma and shock, we withdraw. We go numb.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not seeing everything that's going on. We're looking at the highlights, because just like the body, when we go into shock, we go into triage. What do I have to see? Where is the danger? What do I have to do to get out of danger? We're no longer an objective news reporter seeing the whole picture. Okay, so images are formed by these choppy images that are highlighted because they feel dangerous. And if they happen more than once, if they happen repetitively, when we're very young, and the key word is imprintable, it's like we can be impressed like a soft piece of clay. And if you're impressed once, it'll fade because there are other experiences. But if it happens in a certain way, again and again and again, that imprint is retained. And as we grow, we harden, just like clay dries. And that imprint is there in us. And when we feel that imprint in us, we try to explain it. So first thing that happens is we experience something very difficult and threatening and frightening over and over and over again in different aspects sometimes and sometimes in the same arena.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we start saying, how can I weave this story together? We try to make sense of life. And we come up with a generalization. And then at some point we come up with a conclusion.
I have a generalization.
Okay.
I'm never going into the city again. How's that?
Okay.
Just I went into Boston the other last year, and I really didn't enjoy it. I like Vermont a lot more. It's no traffic jams, and I know exactly where I'm going and how to get there. And then I was in Boston, and I'm like, I'm way out of my league, and this is not cool. It's out of my comfort zone. And as I get older, I do admit that it seems like there's less and less things that are on my fun chart and more things that are on my avoidance chart, unfortunately. And it seems like pathwork could, get me out of that way of thinking. Don't you think?
Pathwork could get you out of that way of thinking, and the reality is you may still continue to feel discomfort when you have to go into the city. Both can be true. And what we talked about in the first hour is the concept of dualistic thinking. Unitive thinking is realizing that both things are true. And not permitting a prejudice in one area to whitewash or brainwash or spill over into other things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about changing what you feel. It's about understanding why you feel that way.
Yeah.
Okay. So for instance, a simple preference, and let's call that a simple preference even though it's expressed adamantly. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that much chaos and confusion. Self-analysis would mean, why is it chaos? Why is it confusion? Because I don't like that much chaos and confusion is naming Boston traffic as chaotic and confusing instead of saying, that's what it's like to me. I wonder what it's like to other people, and I wonder how they are able to think differently. I wonder what I would need to not think the way I think and to see it more... boy, words are failing me this morning. Not banal, but with less prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Might not make me want to go into the city more often. But it would reduce my frustration, anger, the feeling of wanting to point at people and blame, which is not inherently pleasant. So that you could do what you want to do in not fully pleasant situations, be done and come home.
Yeah.
So part of dualistic thinking is knowing what is pleasant and judging everything else as unpleasant, and going one step further and basically saying bad. So pleasant becomes good, and anything else becomes bad. Okay, Vermont good, Boston bad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's where our body goes. That's where the simplistic part of our thinking will go if we don't do something about it. Instead of saying, Vermont, yummy, get lots of it, Boston, tricky, difficult, not so harmonious. I have to work harder, and I get my chores done and my connections met. And I think I'm done. I'm going home. That's the unit of thinking. Instead of thinking that one group of people are crazy and we're sane, which is another example of duality, them and us.
Yeah.
Once again, I remember being in New England on business, and I was driving with my new boss, and we were in a traffic jam on a two-lane road, and he was complaining. Now, I lived in Los Angeles, and we would have four lanes on both sides.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't recognize what he was pointing at as a traffic jam. I just thought it was a crowded road.
Yeah.
Okay. So on a two-lane road, I don't expect anything sometimes except slowing down. But on a eight-lane highway, I can get furious because, good God, we've got eight lanes. What is the problem?
Yeah.
But that's no more realistic.
Well, I guess it's all in your perspective.
Exactly. And the difference here is to realize this may be my perspective, but that does not make it universally true. And that is the trap that we fall into. And understand that what we're talking about is not ultimate reality or ultimate truth. We're talking about why we wind up being tense and unhappy. We're only talking about thought patterns that lead us into feeling miserable. And wouldn't it be nice if we didn't feel so miserable? So again, with your example of going into the city, the intention is not to make it pleasant. That's up to you if you decide it's pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is to not make it so miserable so that you can make a decision based upon what's in your best interest.
Yeah. I could be handing out spiked Laffy Taffy to, like, everyone I met. That would be fun.
Okay, let's look at that, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because it was a kid thing. I know it was a kid thing.
Yeah.
So when you're a kid, you may be looking to jerk people around sometimes. That's what kids do. And it can feel fun and exciting. And we do it with a certain level of innocence. We do it out of boredom. We do it on a deeper spiritual level to find out what other people are made of. You know, kids are brilliant. They have their sixth sense beats ours hand over fist.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they know when something's wrong, but they don't know what it is. So kids have a way of goosing us, of shocking and trying to shove us, because they want to see what happens when we're shoved. And their minds are clocking in all these incidents and all these experiences and trying to make a map. What happens if you pull the trick on old Aunt Bertie? What happens if you pull the trick on the postman? What happens if you pull it? They're looking at different classes of people, different levels of authority and friendship, different characterologies. They're not doing this consciously.
Mm-hmm.
Any more than a two-year-old is aware of physics when they're trying to stand up. But there are a lot of physics about standing up. Anybody who has tried to make a robot walk understands the brilliance of the human mind and skeletal and muscle nervous system. And that's what kids are trying to do. They're trying to figure out their society. They're trying to figure out the human psychology. And they do it with stunts. They do it with tricks.
Excellent.
Yeah. So one of my very, very best teachers taught me something. It was my seventh year. I was in my third year of helpership, seventh year of studies. And I didn't know what it was until very close to the end of the year. she made me realize that I had, without realizing it, become very expert at noticing negativity. Now, that had come from my life. That was my defensive system, to figure out what was negative and avoid it, or do something about it. And without realizing it, I had taken that into my path work, and I was great at noticing negativity. And I had lots of tools for trying to deal with it. What she taught me was, it was a waste of my time. Now, this is my translation, which most of the time when we say something, it's our translation. What she taught me was that rather than chasing negativity and saying, gee, I found it, and gee, I fixed it, which you don't fix, that it was far more loving and useful to find the positive element inside a negative manifestation and encourage it. So, not that I was trying to therapize you, but when you told the story about giving bad-tasting saltwater taffy to a friend of yours and perhaps other people, what I heard, I heard the level of, I pulled a practical joke and it made people feel miserable for a few minutes and I laughed.
Yeah.
That's one layer. Okay. And what I'm speaking of is the deeper layer, where a kid who doesn't necessarily know how to connect with people on a different level want to know what they're made of. What do you do when you're upset? What do you do when you're disappointed? So, yes, on one level we're being negative, or whatever word you wish to use for that situation. But on a deeper level, we are awkwardly exploring our environment.
Mm-hmm.
And if we focus on that, and that's where good parenting comes in. Good parenting when you're dealing with children and grandchildren. Good parenting when you're dealing with the immature portions of yourself. To look at what was my positive intent, even if that was the tiniest part of what I was doing. Let me find and express my positive intent, and let me grow and encourage that part, and forgive myself for the awkward manifestation on an immature or superficial level. Now, when we deal with other people, we can try to do that, but if we haven't actually learned to do that for ourselves, it is very difficult to do it with and for others. When I say do it for others, I mean accepting them in their positive intent, not trying to change them or make them aware of it, necessarily. But there's an energy. And in the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned Barbara Brennan, and you were talking about similarities, and it's a sister discipline mm-hmm. to Pathwork. She was involved with Pathwork. And it's a sister discipline to Core Energetics. And on an energetic and spiritual level, it's a sister discipline to any spiritual pursuit that has a basic truth involved with it, including religions. And in the work that she does, she focuses on the energy. And I found in Pathwork that if I didn't include energy in my understanding of human beings and my interaction, I was missing 90% of the action. Okay? So when you see someone and you sense into the energy of what's going on, you have no real control over the energy they're putting out or how they're interpreting it. You do have control over the energy that you are putting out.
Mm-hmm.
You can recognize where you are being negative, where you are being judgmental, where you are being the spoilsport of the party. And you could knock that off. For a while, you have to just knock it off. You have to make a hard boundary and say, I won't say anything mean. But I call that the equivalent of being Little Chief Thundercloud and not saying a word. It's a cartoon image from my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You may not say anything, but everybody knows you're not happy. Because they look over in the corner of the room and there's a big dark cloud of energy. And even though most people can't name it that way, most people react to a sense of anger or disappointment that someone is holding in. Mm-hmm. They know something's wrong. The problem is that they're going to make their own interpretation of what that is. I had an interaction with a family member a while ago, and it was a disagreement over some facts. And I found out, literally months later, that they thought I lied to them. And they've been holding that for months.
Mm-hmm.
When I never said that, I never meant it, I really never assumed it. I was so focused on what are the facts. And the facts were presented inaccurately. That their interpretation was she thinks I did that deliberately.
Oh.
Okay? We needed to clear that up. And unless you're in constant communication and somebody is honest about it, they don't necessarily tell you what conclusion they came to based on your interaction.
Okay, can I jump in here?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between, well, how do you say you're the dark cloud, me,
because I... Little Chief Thundercloud.
I do it, sure. Everybody does it.
Mm-hmm.
So... Is it safe to say what, in this day and age, say how you feel, or will it be used against you?
When you say safe, please laugh with me on this, that's dualistic.
Okay.
Okay, there's no safety. You can't keep people from deciding to use your words as a weapon. However, in the majority of situations that you're probably in, people aren't specifically looking to attack you.
Yeah.
And by being transparent and being as honest as you can be in the moment, you can defuse a situation. So let me give you an example. It's important to use your own frame of reference instead of trying to throw a conclusion over the whole conversation. So if somebody says, why are you unhappy? You can basically say, I'm having a bad day. Please don't let me ruin the party. You don't have to tell them exactly what your bad day was about. You don't even have to tell them that they're part of your bad day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? In other words, too much truth presumes you know the truth.
Yeah.
So when you say, I'm having a bad day because you're bossy, well, whoa, you haven't probably examined what that whole dynamic is about. So the judgment, you're bossy, and that's why I'm upset, is a little over the top. Even if it's true, imagine how that's going to be received.
Yeah.
So I remember when I first started this work, I remember I was doing a few sessions in the beginning, and I saw this glimmer of light in my Patrick Helper's eyes. And I said, what do you see? Tell me. Because if you just tell me what my problem is, I'll fix it. Mm-hmm. And I hope everybody is laughing like crazy at that, who knows what this work is about. Because the truth is, I wasn't adept enough to manage a profound truth in that moment about my negativities. And I would have simply tried to kick it down the road or suppress it or kill it. And they knew that. So just because something is true does not mean that the other person is fully willing to receive and manage it. And when we make judgments about people, we are demanding that they come up to our level of observation, analysis, understanding, etc. It also presumes that we're right. So, to go back to your question, if you're a little Chief Thundercloud and somebody notices and says, what's wrong? See if you can say what you know to be true. I'm upset. I don't feel good about the conversation. I wonder if we could shift it over here, perhaps. I'm hungry, and I'm not paying attention, and I wonder if we could go ahead and go eat now. There must be some part of your anger that you can see where we could do something about it without throwing judgments out about how you feel that way, why you feel that way, and what their part in it is.
Yes, yes.
I'm not saying to do that all the time. You said, how do you begin to explore that? And what I'm saying is one of the ways to begin to explore that is to be transparent. Now, we started this conversation based on holidays and stress and family stuff. So if it's okay, I'll go through some tools.
Absolutely.
That have to do with these theories. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the first theory I talked about was dualistic thinking. And I like to call them a toolbox. These are some tools you can use to notice if you're in dualistic thinking. And they are always, or if you are, or somebody else is. And they are the words always, never, only, but, and or. You're always thinking like that. You never help out. This is the only way. Yes, I like that, but. Because that instantly throws away the I like that, but. And turns the sentence into what you want or what they want. And or is the classic. We can do it this way or that way defines the conversation sometimes. And it eliminates any option that nobody has really had the time to think of. Okay? Mm-hmm. So when you say that or when you hear that, it's a clue that maybe there's some black and white thinking going on. And instead of reacting to that, and when someone says, you never help, instead of trying to defend yourself, I do help, and this is the time, and this is the place, and instead of defending that, to say, they're in a mindset where they have forgotten the places where I help, and they're only noticing the places where I don't, and this particular moment seems to exemplify that. Do you see how that might soften the reaction you would have?
Yes.
Because in reaction to that, you never help. The reaction is, I help a lot. It's a contradiction. And it's a confrontation not only of what they said, but how they feel. And instead of trying to meet them where they are, I see you're stressed. I see your field of vision has narrowed. And once again, I love physiology, because when we are triggered, when we go into physical defense, one of the things that happen is we lose our peripheral vision. We become tunnel vision oriented. We only see what's in front of us. And that's what happens when we are emotionally stressed. We no longer see the rainbow. We only see one color.
Yeah.
Or black or white. Emotional reactions versus feelings, there's a lot of indicators, but for instance, one is that an emotional reaction is subjective, and a feeling is truth-based. Now, that's tricky. Truth-based doesn't mean true. It means it's reacting to something. And if you're not dualistic, you understand that could be a little bit murky, but it still has some value. There's still something there. It's not the truth. So my being sad does not mean the news is sad or the situation is sad. It's just sad to realize the difficulties of being human sometimes. So an emotional reaction is aimed at someone or at something. Something is the source of my disharmony. And a feeling is to feel disharmony without coming to a conclusion about it. So those are tools to tell the difference.
Okay.
In terms of images, whenever you come to a headline or a shorthand, she's always like that. Well, number one, it's dualistic thinking. And secondly, that's a picture. That's a snapshot of who someone is. And people are not snapshots. They're more complex than that. So when we catch ourselves thinking dualistically or thinking subjectively instead of trying to find a deeper truth, or when we are judging and making conclusions about someone, these are clues that we're not fully in reality. Wanted to get those tools in there before we were done.
Thank you. You know, and I had a whole list of stuff to talk about, but on top of what you were talking about, but a couple thoughts came up. And there's the path work often says to go into this soft pain thing versus a hard pain. And now, and then the pathwork also says that the world is not 100% happy or 100% unhappy. It's 50% of both.
Mm-hmm. That's a way of looking at it, yes.
And now me, as, you know, my inner child, wants everything to be happy all the time. And perhaps immaturely, I'm, you know, striving for to make myself happy and everyone else happy around me. Where is the fault in that, Jan?
Well, I think you've just expressed it. I heard you use the word make everybody happy.
Okay.
You may not have been conscious of that, but I'm laughing at myself because there's a lecture about that, and it's what they call a Freudian slip, but it's important to hear what we say. Even if we say that's not what I meant, that's what we said, and so it indicates that there might be a tendency towards what we said. The words we use are important. They're not supposed to be used to attack us or our motives. They are indicators. So when I listened to people, I heard, make other people happy. And that is not possible. It's just not possible. You can't make someone happy. You can facilitate their happiness. You can support their happiness. You can encourage. You can share. There's a lot of things you can do to help someone else shift how they feel about life. But the need to make someone happy is a forcing current and a distortion.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that you're full of forcing currents and distortions, but most human beings have some.
Yeah.
Okay? So you want to be happy all the time is also dualistic. And you identified it. It's an immature part of yourself. We all have immature aspects of ourselves. A grown person, and I only deal with adults. I don't do this work with children. It's not appropriate for children. Number one, they already know the truth. They just don't know why it doesn't exist in the world. And adults have experienced the difficulties of the world. They want to know, where'd the truth go?
Yeah.
And that's where spiritual work comes in. When you say you want to be happy all the time, it's dualistic in the sense that not being happy is not the same as being unhappy. There's a rainbow here. There's a spectrum. And wanting to be happy all the time is like a little kid sitting on one end of the rainbow saying, this is where I want to be, and I'm not interested in the spectrum. So there's got to be some fear about if I'm not happy, I'll fall all the way to the other end of the spectrum and I'll be unhappy. Instead of saying, wow, today was boring. A little frustrating, too. Didn't get anything done. And then trying to figure out why today was boring, why you didn't get anything done, and figuring out, as an adult, how to responsibly create some redirection in your life to reduce frustration, to introduce more pleasant activity or interesting activity, which will result in making you feel satisfied, which will lead to some level of happiness. And that's our job as adults.
Mm-hmm.
So there is always the immature infant tyrant who says, my way or the highway. And if we give in to that, we get the life that child tries to create, which is out of touch with reality and not conducive to interacting with other people. So as one of the Pathwork lectures talks about, and psychology also follows through on, because truth is truth no matter how you couch it, if you spoil a child and make them think that they can have everything they want one day, no matter how much money you have, no matter how much power you have, that kid is going to hit some place where they can't have what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Now, publicly, we may not see that moment. So publicly, we may see people who, in the news headlines, get everything they want and never have to pay for anything they've hurt or done wrong. But that's headlines. That's not real life. And biographies are really useful because if you look at a biography, a really good biography, every great person has been through a lot of trial and tribulation. They're great only because they seem to have overcome it. And on a deeper level, I have known a lot of great people that nobody will ever hear about. They just didn't make the headlines.
Yeah.
Well, there's no difference between those two lives spiritually, except one was noticed and one was not. And in the people that I know, where I know the facts and I have experienced interaction, I have seen people go downhill most of their lives. But that doesn't mean they're bad. According to the Pathwork, they're manifesting a false belief. And as long as it's got a stranglehold on them, and as long as they don't lift themselves into a higher state of knowing, they must naturally suffer for embracing that false belief.
And I have a thing that I wrote down as a question. As kids and adults, we are bombarded with false images. Since society is acting in a collective false image of itself, does that mean breaking free is antisocial?
I love that question. That's a great, that observation. That's great. Once again, let's look at it from the positive. Think about the story, The Emperor's New Clothes. Was the kid who told the truth antisocial? Yes, on some level. Haven't we all, as children, pointed at someone and said, look at the lady with the funny hat? And our mother say, shh. Is that antisocial? Yes. Is there truth in it? Yes. We're not, however, considering the feelings of the other person. We're not necessarily mature in our expression of our truth. We're not necessarily being kind. We're not necessarily being loving. Being kind and loving and expressing only the truth that seems to remain in the moment. If those three things are present, you are not antisocial. You are nudging society. You are being a member of society who says we're on the wrong track. I'll give you another example. The ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. I have heard, I'm a fan of them, and I've heard them take on cases, and I go, what? You can't defend that person because I don't want that person defended. I want the other person defended.
Yeah.
Okay? But I admire the organization because they're trying to work on principles. They're trying to say, you may not like this, but it's right. And I think that's where they get their respect from. I was lecturing at one point. God, I hope this doesn't sound arrogant, but it was in China. And we were trying to give people a flavor of password because some books have been translated into Chinese lately. And we thought we'd try to give that society a nudge. And I was speaking in front of a group of graduate students. And one of them jumped up and said, "What do you think of Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize?" And I thought, oh, dear. You know, it's like, oh, dear. Yeah. And what I tried to say, I can't repeat my exact words, but what I tried to say was this. There's an underlying premise in that question. That is, the Nobel Prize means the Nobel Prize belongs to all of us, and we should all agree with it. But the reality of the Nobel Prize is there's, I don't know how many people on the Nobel Committee. Let's use the figure 10. There could be 100, but I'm going to use the figure 10 for just to move on with this sentence. There are 10 people on the Nobel Prize Committee, and their job is to give the prize to whom they believe deserves it. And the reputation of the Nobel Prize comes from the consistency of their decisions. I call that a batting average.
Mm-hmm.
They have a batting average that's pretty good, and that's why the Nobel Prize is honored. There are many prizes in the world that aren't honored, and they're laughed at. Perhaps because there's not an underlying integrity. But just because you have underlying integrity doesn't mean you don't make a boner decision sometimes. It happens. So the challenge, do I think that so-and-so deserves the Peace Prize? I don't know. But 10 people did who have a pretty good reputation for picking out people that have nudged the world in a certain direction.
Yes.
And if they made a mistake this time, so be it. But you see, making a mistake is a dualistic statement. Maybe they didn't make a mistake, but they didn't select someone that everybody agrees with. Well, that's quite different than their underlying belief that this person nudged the world in a certain direction. So I am trying to answer your question. In dualistic thinking, we're constantly looking at one way or the other way. Instead of looking at the positive intention behind people's action. The Nobel Prize Committee is not after glory or fame. They're really not. Why? Because then they'd be choosing movie stars or that's glory and fame in today's lingo.
Yeah.
They're trying to do a certain job and not everybody agrees with them. And they take heat for it. But instead of caving in and changing their intention, they may evaluate their intentions more closely. They may undergo process about saying, were we wrong? And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about looking at a difficult or unpleasant situation and saying, let's take it home. Can't fix it right here. Let's take it home and look at it. Perhaps I had a part in the dynamic. If I had a part in the dynamic, what was it? And where did it come from?
Yeah.
That's all we're talking about. And what I try to explain to people, and I used earlier the example of biting your nails. You realize you're biting your nails, and you want to stop. The question is why? Do you want to be beautiful and have beautiful nails? I mean, go get them manicured. Go get a set of false nails. Or are you concerned about something deeper, which is, I wonder if there's something bugging me that is manifesting in these bitten nails, which is traditionally the presumption. Okay. And to do the work to explore that and to notice objective feedback, I'm not biting them as often. Now, sometimes that's because you found another habit, smoking, drinking, whatever. That's not a solution. That's just displacement. And you can displace something and then not notice that the underlying cause is continuing because the effect that you were worried about is gone. But eventually, the displacement behavior will will also concern you. Because the original sense that something was wrong will pick up on the new behavior when it begins to manifest negatively. And this is the work of adults. So the immature part of you, that's not who's talking to me right now. You're speaking of the immature part. You are not that reality, even though that reality may take center stage on occasion.
Yeah. On occasion, it can with all of us, I believe.
It certainly can.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is Jan Rigsby, pathwork teacher and helper. JanRigsby.com is her website, JanRigsby.com. And she gives monthly teleconferences, I believe.
Well, they're weekly and they're free.
Weekly.
And the information's on the website, yeah.
Yeah. Which are very cool. It's cool to get an email from Jan Rigsby. I get them, and it's like you get all this juicy information to mull over, and it's real fun. So I encourage people to get in contact with her and get that weekly email or monthly email.
It's a choice between monthly and weekly contacts. So
okay.
Some people have enough on their plate already.
Mm-hmm. And this, I'd say, might be the new form of psychology of the future. Is that a fair statement?
I would say that there are different needs for different people. Psychology addresses a certain level of awareness and understanding. What the Pathwork Guide taught me, what the Pathwork Lectures taught me, was frankly how judgmental I had become. And so I actively work to reverse that. I like to think that there's a science and a psychology and a job and a profession and a relationship for every person on the planet. And to notice my own preferences. And to allow my energy to be set free in the area where I seem to work best. So I don't think it's replacing psychology. It's a different type and level of understanding. And if people are attracted to it, great. And if they're not attracted to it, there are many, many, many other options.
Mm-hmm. There are quite a few options. And
mm-hmm.
And it seems like collectively we're moving towards some sort of higher consciousness. Information is everywhere, thanks to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how is evil ultimately self-destructive by sowing the seeds of its own annihilation? Or in other words, does the evil self-sabotage itself to make way for good?
So I think that's the answer to your question. I'm laughing because we got a few minutes and that's a big topic. But I think you answered it. And I'll give you a different phrasing for it, but you did. And it self sabotages itself. Why? The Pathwork teaches that negativity and evil are finite. They run out of steam. They run out of energy. There's no joy there. And people say, oh, these people are gleeful when they chop off people's heads. In the moment, do you really think that's a lifestyle choice? Or are they in reaction?
Yeah.
Okay. So a lot of what we call evil in the world is destructive behavior that is generated by fury and anger that was not alleviated. And the grain of truth is it wasn't alleviated. The grain of truth is the government in charge of people are not taking care of their people. And the more educated and aware we become, the more dissatisfied we become with the reality of government, the reality of politics, and the compromises that need to happen when, for instance, in this country, you've got over 300 million people, and there's just nobody's going to make everybody happy. Somebody's got to compromise. No law is going to include everybody who needs it or exclude people that can take advantage of it. Just not going to happen. And that's the basis of what you call, what you referred to, which is the 50-50 philosophy, which is a school in Pathwork, saying you just don't always get what you want. The second thing about this is that while evil may be finite and run out of joy eventually, it can sure be prevalent in the moment in some aspects, in some areas of the world. Okay. The Pathwork suggests something that is counterintuitive, and that is that we need to understand individually how we foster evil in our own lives. We need to understand how we contribute to misery in the world, where we make people unhappy because we're not willing to be aware. That we can manage, that we can control. But people are bombing each other. Well, that's going to take a little bit more time to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of saying, can I stop what hurts me from happening? No. But you can change your attitude towards it. You can become a better person. You can create better relationships. You can become more creative and full of joy and energy. Find ways to focus your energy that have positive or constructive elements. Instead of sitting in a dead-end job, in a dead-end relationship, being miserable and lashing out at people. That you can change.
That should come with a cigarette warning, you know, disclaimer, quitting your jumping out of your moving car while you're going 50 miles an hour, you might get a broken leg. So you might want to think this over before you make any sudden jumps. But
So again, I go back to the Pathwork Lecture 127, which talks about the spiritual evolution. There's personality development. There's all kinds of different stages of development. In the spiritual stage of development, you go from not understanding connections and not understanding your part into awareness. Lecture 127 says that awareness is the most painful stage, because coming into awareness can be abrupt and disheartening and scary and discouraging, and you haven't yet moved into the third stage, which is understanding.
Yeah.
And as you bounce back and forth, because it's nonlinear, as you bounce back and forth, you can be in despair because I want the knowing. Well, you're in process. And that's what you described when you talked about the phrase soft pain and hard pain. Hard pain believes that if you're not there, you'll never get there. Soft pain says, I'm on my way, but I'm not there yet.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. And thank you very much, Jan. I'd love to have you back on the air at a future date. Because it seems
Thanks for the opportunity. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it tremendously. And I thank you very much. And I'm sure the listeners appreciated your knowledge and gift to think about. So have a happy holiday, Jan. And we'll talk
to you
too,
and to your, all your listeners as well.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
WGDR Plainfield, WGDH Hardwick, Goddard College Community Radio, 91.1 FM and 91.7 FM. Online at WGDR.org and Facebook. Democracy Now! Is brought to you in part by Positive Pi in Plainfield, Positive Pi in Montpelier, and Positive Pi in Hardwick, featuring pizzas, entrees, drinks, live music, and more. For more information, please visit www.positivepi.com.
WGDR Plainfield, WGDH Hardwick, Goddard College Community Radio.